Hello and welcome to the first episode of the Knife Life podcast. If you've been looking for a place to hang out and talk knives, then you found it. My name is Eugene Kwan, and you can find me under that name on Instagram and on YouTube.
I'm Frank. I'm Dr. Frunky. You can find me on YouTube at Dr. Frunky with a K-E-Y at the end, and on Instagram under the same name. You can email me at drfrunky@gmail.com, too, if you have any questions.
My name is Mike. I go by Bloom and Blade on Instagram, nothing on YouTube. So just hit me up on Instagram if you need anything. Thanks.
Yeah, and I'm Charlie. I go by Accidentally Nice. The accidentally is misspelled, unironically. It's the only way you're going to find me.
Hopefully. Yeah, I actually tried to find you spelling it the right way, and I couldn't.
It's on purpose. I know how it works.
Nice. Well, we're all really excited for our first episode. This is just pretty awesome to be part of this. And to kick things off, we thought that it would be pretty fun to talk about whatever knives or even just even a single knife, however good or bad it was, you know, whatever knives were the first to kind of get our knife life started. I think all of us have a knife that kind of pushed us over the edge. Maybe it wasn't even our first actual knife, but all of us probably can remember that knife that just kind of turned it on for us. And so, yeah, Frank, you want to actually start for us and let us know what was the first knife that kind of got you into all this?
Yeah, I can definitely do that. Thanks. I would say that I, you know, randomly used knives when I was younger, growing up. I had like a little Swiss Army knife that I had when I was a kid, and I probably got my first folding knife when I was like 15, but I didn't know what to do with it. It was a CRKT. I just kind of kept it stored away because I thought it was dangerous. I didn't really know. The reason that I got into knives, and this is a ridiculous story, is that I had a neighbor in an apartment complex in Chicago that I thought was mentally unstable. I hope he doesn't listen to this because that's a problem. In any case, in Chicago, you can't own a gun very easily. And so I bought a knife. I bought a huge K-Bar Tanto knife, and I typed in like tactical knife, and I bought the first thing that I saw. And then I read about it, and I was like, okay, so it's made out of 1095 steel. What the hell is that? And so I read about it, and then, you know, I went on and learned about some stuff, and then I bought a Spyderco Domino, and then I bought a Benchmade 940. Just because I was like, okay, these are knives that I could carry with me every day. These are interesting things. And then it kind of springboarded from there. I think the next two knives I got were the 0392, the ZT, because I wanted to try the 562, but I ended up getting that 392 first. And then I got a Spyderco Nirvana. And, you know, that probably took from the time I bought that K-Bar to the time I bought the Spyderco Nirvana was probably 2 years, maybe. And then it kind of just slowly went from there. And then I bought a bunch of smaller kind of Spydercos and ZTs and stuff. And then from there, a friend of mine was like, hey, man, you have so many knives. You should make a YouTube channel. You can record a few of these knives that we have together. And, so I made a video about the Spyderco Nirvana and the 0392, and they were really bad, but I just kept making them. And now I have a YouTube channel. Here it is. Like I've been going just over 2 years. Actually, September 2 years ago was the beginning of that channel. And so here I am now, and I've definitely gotten much deeper into the custom knife world. And so it's just been a real trip from there. You can actually literally watch the chronicling of my addiction spiraling out of control on YouTube live. So that's kind of my story. And as it stands right now, my collection is predominantly custom knives, a few high-end production knives, and really a couple of regular production knives, a couple of Spydercos, a ZT, the Mass Drop Thresher. So I kind of have a broad range of interests, but it's definitely more in the higher end and custom end as of right now.
So that kind of raises a question for me that maybe a lot of our listeners are wondering too. But you said that you got your first knife because of quote, tactical reasons, right?
Yeah.
Did you?
Totally misguided. It's just the wrong idea. I had no idea what I was doing.
So wrong.
So did you ever have to use it or feel like you got close to needing to use it in that kind of application?
No, the one time, the thing that made me want to get it, the episode that made me want to get it was really the isolated episode. This guy had just a total breakdown in front of me, and I felt weird because it was, you know, I don't want to go into the specifics because I don't want to die, but, you know, it was a weird situation. Yeah, so it was totally misguided, but really what it started was just that total, I'm going to go online and shop for something, and I'm going to learn about it, and just like anything else, read a review, watch a review, and then it spirals from there. So that was really the thing that started me. Kind of funny. Something that also accelerated it is the fact that I work in healthcare. I am a doctor. I'm a resident physician in neurosurgery, and I live in Louisiana. And so a bunch of the people in and around my work at the hospital, all the male nurses at least, all carry a pocket knife. And most of the men around here carry a pocket knife anyways. And so it's kind of a cultural thing too. So that definitely threw gas on the fire when I moved here and started residency.
So what was your first, like, real knife?
Define real knife. You know, I guess you could say it's a Spyderco Domino, Benchmade 940.
Yeah, probably. I would consider those real knives.
I would consider that a real knife. I don't remember which one I bought first. I think I bought them, like, within a week of each other. And so that was where I started. I think I had watched, like, a Nut and Fancy video on the 940. He had, like, 100 videos on the 940, so I got that, and I looked up Spyderco because that was common, and it was like that was the new knife that they had just come out with at the time, so I just bought that.
Have you ever Googled best knife?
I have not. No, I've never just typed that in. But I do use that on my YouTube videos for the search. There's like hot links for the searches. I like type in best knife or best tactical or like top 10.
Top 10 best EDC knife kind of thing.
Get it. That's how you get viewers, man. It's all a game.
I'll have to look into that a little bit. I'll have to check that out. But yeah, I mean, anyone who takes a look at your Instagram channel knows that you have gone pretty deep into the custom territory. And yeah, the trajectory that you've been on has been pretty rapid and a pretty steep incline, but I mean, it's really exciting for us all to be able to see like pictures of that. And I know that I personally was actually pretty influenced by the some of the choices you made buying different knives and reviewing them, but I'll get to that when I get to my piece. But yeah, Mike, what about you? How did you get started into all this?
I got into knives completely accidentally, and most of it was Charlie's fault. I met him on Reddit when I discovered
knives.
Yes. when I discovered Knife Raffle, the old raffle site, and I just went on a really lucky, just because I like to gamble, and I went on a really lucky win spree. And I think the first one that I remember was a ZT-0562, and I just dug it mechanically. I thought it was nice. At the time, I thought it was a fancy knife because it was worth whatever those are worth, a couple $100. And then I got a couple CRKs, and those are the first ones that left an impression on me, how nice they could be. I had a couple of Menandis that I really liked. And then the first nice one that I got was a neon light, and Charlie convinced me to buy it. It was on Blade Forums, and this is when they were pretty hot. I think it ended up being about 7 or 710. And I got that, and I was really blown away, and that's when I appreciate the first knife I had with that really crazy, with really nice action, and the first, you know, first Shiro. And then from there, I got really into, I think also from Charlie, I got a Thorburn L36M, because, you know, Charlie said, hey, you got to check out this maker. And from that, maybe an S. It was an S. But it was a Thorburn. It was my first South African knife. I loved it. And then I really went down a pretty deep South African hole where I just was, you know, trying to get something from every maker that I could discover. And then from there, I finally, over the last 8 months, 9 months, I started branching out and not being so focused on South African knives, as much as I love some of the South African makers. as everybody knows. And that whole thing, that was a little under 3 years ago, and that was it. But I didn't grow up using a knife. If 3 years ago, if somebody said I spent $50 on a knife, I would have clowned on them. You know, like, what are you doing? What a waste. And now, you know, well, I'm in the same boat as you all were.
So what happens? Like,
crazy boat.
What happened to this whole South African thing? I remember you were talking about, like, South African visas and...
I was going to be, you know what, when I started to put them on Instagram, and when I started spending more time on Instagram and discovering a couple small makers, like, for instance, Bester, who makes the Rattel, you know, he had 40 makers, maybe 40 followers rather. And, I just really liked the looks of all the South African stuff. A lot of them seem to be, you know, clearly influenced by Thorburn in design and in action. Mm-hmm. And I just really, you know, really loved the general aesthetic. For a while, I thought, like, you know, I'm going to be the South African guy on Instagram. But then I just got a couple other knives that were so, you know, so overwhelming, so terrific that I quickly realized that that was a silly commitment. And I started to drift a little out of it and just, you know,
you don't have to feel bad about the world. It. You almost sound like you're upset about it, like. You're offending somebody.
I know. And you know what? I actually do feel that way.
Yeah.
But so now I'm a citizen of the world. I got some different stuff, and that's where I'm at now.
Nice. You have an excellent collection. You have a very broad and awesome collection.
Oh, thanks, Frank.
It's starting to get really colorful, though. You know what
it
I
is
mean?
Starting to get colorful. I know.
Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, with those, I mean, that's kind of the problem, right? I mean, it's one of the best problems to have, but, like, to have so many different options out there, you get kind of that Pokemon gotta catch them all kind of feeling where you just gotta try everything that's out there, and it can add up definitely pretty quickly. But speaking of adding up, someone who is no stranger to some pretty expensive stuff, Charlie, yeah, how did you get started with your knife life?
So I guess I started not really with knives, but with – I used to be really into the danglers, you know, the –
What?
I think
what is that?
So specifically, I was really into the Monroe dangler. It was like just this
That sounds like some sort of horrific sex act or something, you know?
No, it's
the Monroe
it's like
dangler.
The Monroe
it's like
dangler.
A single piece multi tool. You know, it's okay. It's one of those. I guess from where I'm from, the most important thing on your keychain besides your keys is probably your bottle opener. So I was just looking for like a more functional bottle opener. And then I found the Atwood tools, the Peter Atwood tools. The Monroe dangler was one of them. And these are all like $200 back then for like a piece of titanium, right? So couldn't really afford that. I could, but I couldn't justify it at the time. This was like probably about 6 or 7 years ago. And then I started looking into pocket knives. I don't remember why. It was just one of those things that, you know, you're on this whole EDC site all the time, and you eventually get onto the knives. I think the first two I bought were, so I Googled best knife and then came out.
What is best knife per
it's
Google?
Mini grip. What comes up? Mini grip
mini,
chillion.
Yeah, it's,
mini grip?
It's,
mini
grip chillion. It's mini grip or PM2. It's one of those, but.
Those are not, honestly, not bad recommendations.
Yeah.
It's really sick. So,
yeah.
I think ultimately I went with the mini grip because I think it was a EDC commentary article that was like, if you haven't tried an Axis Lock, you need to try an Axis Lock. And the PM2 is just really big. I ended up getting a Dragonfly 2 and a mini grip. Those were my two, I wouldn't say they're gateway drugs, because after that I bought nothing for like 2 years.
It's very interesting that you and I both started with a Benchmade and a Spyderco at the same time.
Mm. Yeah, I think before even getting the mini grip, I ordered a ZDP Dragonfly 2. because I learned about this whole super steel thing, right? And then the mini grip has like, I think it's 154 cm. And I'm like, that's not very good, even though I've never used it, and it's better than everything I have. I'm just like, I need CBD.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Wait, it's what it's like with everything now.
You developed a taste for it.
Yeah, I think from there, it was pretty slow. Just, I kind of worked my way up very slowly over the course of like 2 or 3 years. It took me a while before I bought, I got anything within like the $500 range. A lot of it was back then was all about practicality. I tried to make like the Dragonfly work on a keychain. It did not work. I tried to make a mini grip work on the keychain. So I would just like put a keychain through the lanyard hole and try to clip it to my keys. But then it's like really heavy on a keychain, you know, even like,
yeah,
it's really freaking heavy for keys.
Especially so for your ignition. If it's plugged in there, yeah, it's just going to be dangling off of your ignition. Yeah.
And the pocket clip doesn't really serve a purpose if it's on your keys. So.
Except it just looks like a dick. Because it's a benchmark. It's a good purpose there to serve.
Yeah.
There you go.
I mean, I didn't know you could get free clips back then, so I had the base one that was less penis-y.
That's good. That's good. I can't stand those clips.
I think my gateway knife was probably the Neon also. And I think I picked that up pretty early on. I want to say it was like March 2016. I think I paid like $850 for it because they didn't really have, they weren't available anywhere. You can get them on Recon One. This was before Recon One, I think. You just couldn't find them. So the Neon Light was like, in my head, kind of the perfect knife. And I would just buy that and stop.
And I think in a lot of ways, I think it still is the perfect knife.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
I think
you could argue.
Yeah, it's one of the knives, like, the models I've owned the longest in terms of a Neon, I guess. I don't have the Light anymore, but I have a Neon. And I think up until that point, I've had, like, Chris Reed knives. I've had a few mid-techs, like the Ferrum Forge stuff. I don't know if they're customs, but... I've had those, and kind of the Neon is just not even a comparison to everything else I've owned. So after getting the Neon, I ended up selling probably like, I had like 60 knives at the time. I sold at least like 40 of them just right then and there. I was like, the Neon is just better than everything else I own. And I don't need to have this 940 collection. It doesn't make sense. I had like 5 940 variants, and it was just kind of a waste. So I think that's when I really like kind of went for the, quality over quantity thing.
That's definitely a phase that I think a lot of us have had.
Yeah,
I'm still trying. I'm still trying to get out of it.
Yeah.
So I think that once I got that, that's really kind of what opened my eyes to knives that are just really super quality and to a point where it's unnecessary. I think that's when I also got less and less practical. Because I'm like, I very rarely need a knife in my life, but I would like to have a knife in my life. So it wasn't really about practicality. I didn't try to clip my Neon to my keys or anything like that. so I think where I am now, a lot of it is almost the opposite of practicality. I actually like my knives to, in an ideal world, operate very effectively as a knife. But for the purposes of my collection, it doesn't really matter. It's just one of those things where, you know, I believe it can do all these things, but whether or not I'm going to do them doesn't matter. It's just like my little beliefs that I have that I still care about. Yeah.
Absolutely. That's where I'm at too. And I have probably the most limited practicality living in New York. Since I live in New York City, where I'm not going to carry anything I have. There's too great a risk that it's going to get confiscated and I might even get arrested for having one. So really at a certain point, I mean, how much are you going to carry in your pocket if there's that danger? So I really almost never have them with me.
Frank, you've mentioned before that you use your knives pretty frequently, right?
I do. Yeah. I try to, I find reasons to use my knives. Absolutely. I wouldn't say that I hard use my knives by any means. Like, I don't have a job where I'm like cutting carpet or drywall or opening paint cans and stuff. Like, I don't do that kind of work all day, but I certainly find reasons to cut things open. I have to open a lot of packages. I have to cut rope sometimes at work for certain surgeries. I have to put people in traction. So I have to, like, not tie them down, but use traction. So we have to use this kind of, like, nice rope. And so I have to cut a length of rope and then tie some knots and, you know, put somebody in traction. And so,
are there traction devices, though? Like that?
So you're with a, patient,
yes, but,
and you
I
pull
live
out
in
like
Louisiana.
A Rob Carter?
Yes. Yeah, I pull out my talent. So, like, or say that, like, we're in surgery, or like they're coming in the ER, or I've cut people's clothes off with my knives before. It's a real thing. And so I try to use it when I can.
Oh, that's terrific.
Okay. Confession time. Have you ever actually, cut anything internal to the human body?
I would be in jail.
You can be honest, man. Come on.
I have never. No, I would tell you I would, but no, I've never crossed that line. I cut sutures. Not cut sutures out that were in, but like when I put them in and there was like a tail left, I would cut them off with the knife. But that's about as close as I've got. Never used it on a patient's skin. I would not do that. That would be
okay. Okay. Here's another question related to that. Then, have you ever been frustrated with the kind of surgical steel edge holding capabilities in your scalpels?
Yes, actually, they go dull quite quickly. Some people say that scalpels are M390. They don't say M390. They say surgical stainless. I think this is like China crap because it goes dull very quickly.
Mm-mm-mm. But yeah, then like, do you have like a mid-surgery sharpening session? Is that you bring out your wicked edge?
And... yeah, I have the KME set up on the back table. No, we just get a new blade. Just throw a new blade on it. Yeah.
You've got a nurse over there just running the system the whole time, just pulling out the
beast
50 grit.
It's interesting to me, and I can just touch on this now, but like we use different blade shapes in the OR, and the people that I'm working with have no idea what to call these things. Like a 10 blade is a clip point, or a 10 blade is a drop point, a 15 blade is a clip point, and an 11 blade is a Warncliffe. But like I can't be like, can I have the Warncliffe blade, please? Yeah, they're not going to know what the hell I'm saying.
They're like, guys, Wednesday. It's Wednesday. Warning Wednesday. Come on.
Yeah, give me the Warncliffe. Give me the number 11. And so, yeah. But I have those thoughts in the OR for sure.
All right. Well, you know, it's funny because I feel like every one of your stories has a little bit of similarity to one another and to mine as well, but also unique. My journey with knives, I guess it began kind of subliminally when I was young. Like I grew up in the Midwest, and so we were always just shooting BB guns and going fishing and just being around knives all the time. And I had a lot of friends who were hunters and all that, but never really had this sense of, oh, I need to have a knife on me, even though it would have been perfect because Indiana has such open laws for carry and all that. But it was actually not until I took my first job, my first full-time position as the pastor of a church, that I started getting into knives. And that's kind of a weird pair of dots to connect. But so it was kind of this roundabout thing where, as a pastor, you end up ordering books and supplies for the ministry, like, constantly. So I was getting maybe 3 or 4 or 5 Amazon packages, boxes, you know, envelopes, padded envelopes, whatever it was. I was getting all this kind of stuff probably like 3, 4, 5 times a week, you know. And so I got to this point where I was just tired of using my keys to open everything up and getting the teeth on the keys all gunky with the tape and everything. So I decided to go online and buy some box cutters or something, or just find some box cutters somewhere. But then I thought to myself, you know, a box of box cutters would probably cost like $10. If I just spend 15 or 20, I could conceivably buy a knife, right? I mean, that's probably how much they cost. It can't really be much more than that. You know, that's what I was thinking. So I started
down
searching
the
around.
Rabbit hole he goes.
I know, right? I started searching around, and then I find this knife, and I actually have it in front of me right now. I brought it out for the recording of this episode. It is the CRKT Stubby Folding Razel. So this was before I knew anything about Graham knives. Yeah. This is a collaboration he did way back that they did way back when. So this knife is like just under 2 inches long blade length. It's got that classic razel shape, so you've got that chisel kind of shape going on at the end, except this one's V-ground. And I got this knife because, number one, it had ram's horn scales on it, but then really big, thick, exposed stainless steel liner. So I thought it looked kind of cool. It was small, so I knew it would fit in my pocket easily. And because the blade shape was that weird razel kind of blade shape that they're so known for, it didn't really look like a knife to my wife. And so my wife was like, oh, yeah, I wouldn't be as scared of that. And every other knife design I'd shown her up to that point, she was scared of. So I decided, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and pull the trigger on this. It's $25. I can't believe I'm spending $25 on a knife. How can I face my church after this? You know, like I was going through the whole cycle, but I ordered it and I just fell in love with this thing. But it didn't serve me that well, to be honest. This is not a knock on CRKT, but, I just didn't understand much about, you know, like knife chemistry and proper knife maintenance. I didn't know anything about ram's horn and why you shouldn't expect good ram's horn on a $25 knife. And so, you know, the scales started splitting and warping and falling apart. Basically, the clip got exposed to a little bit of water and just broke off. And then, you know, I've got all these rust spots all over the outside and the inside of the knife. And,
water,
you know, I mean,
it's a clip off. What?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty brutal. Just how, honestly, yeah, it's not a bad knife, but it's kind of a bad knife. You know what I mean? Like it just didn't have the materials that would really give it much longevity. And so the thing fell apart in like 2 years. I'm trying to play with it right now and it's like so hard to open this thing. it's just ridiculous, but that kind of got me a little bit confused. Kind of like you, Frank, I was a little bit like, okay, so what did I just buy? And so I started looking up some reviews and reading them. I must have spent like an entire summer watching Nuttin' Fancy. I think I watched like 600 of his videos or whatever. You know, came to realize, oh, the knife that I got, it was good for $25, but $25 isn't the ceiling when it comes to knives, not even production knives, you know? So, yeah, I moved on to like a Rat 2. I think I got a couple Opinel knives. I don't know. I just started exploring around a little bit. And actually, like you, Charlie, my first like real knife in my mind was the Benchmade Mini Griptilian. And I understand what you mean about trying to put on your keys because, I mean, it looks like a small thing, you know? And it is. It's a great knife, and I still have it. It cut me really, really bad the first time I opened it. And so, yeah, I have some good memories there. But just side note, real quick, side note. Yeah, the first time I opened the knife, too, I noticed that the blade was rubbing against the handle scales. So this is like Benchmade at its finest, you know? This is like peak Benchmade. My first exposure to it, the blade was so off-center that it started rubbing the handles and everything. And so I actually sent it back because I was thinking, this is the greatest knife ever. I want it to be perfect. And I think that idea, like looking for the greatest knife ever and then wanting it to be perfect, kind of fueled my search for the next knife after that and the knife after that and so on and so forth. And so these days, I think where I'm at is I like dipping my toes into some of the, I guess, quote unquote, more affordable customs. A lot of times these are CNC customs that clock in between $600 to $900. I like dipping my toes in there, but I generally focus mostly on the $400 to $600 price range with mid-techs and high-end customs. But every now and then, I check out what's going on in the production knife world. In fact, one of my other side jobs requires me to do so and keep tabs on that. And so in a couple of weeks, I'll probably end up having a chance to review the Spyderco Brower. That's a knife that just got released that I'm pretty interested in. Small little EDC knife, titanium frame lock, G10 show scale. Looks to be a great little user. And so I like finding little quality knives like that in any price range. But that's generally where I stick to these days.
Speaking of nice little users, by the way, I just saw you picked up a Goblin, I just noticed today.
Yes, I actually got this goblin at Blade Show 2018. So
I've had one for a while.
I've had it since June, and I mean, I was one of those guys who camped out in front of the door, from the wee hours of the morning. I think I got there, at like 6 or 5:30, 5:45 in the morning.
Like 5:45, man. I remember.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was there, standing in line. I had to have been like in the 70s at that point. You know, like there was still like 65 or 70 people in front of me. But camped out, you know, stood outside, and then I had the early bird pass, so I got in at noon, and I knew where I was going. I knew that I wanted to pick up one of these mini goblins. It was one of my first stops. So I ran over to a couple other tables, picked up some knives, and then hit the Koenig table and made sure I picked up one of these protos. And I love it. I mean, the only thing they changed between the prototype and the full production mini goblin is they just enlarged the sharpening tool. They may have made one other slight adjustment, but yeah, I mean, the proto was pretty much a finished design by the time that Blade Show rolled around. So yeah, that's what I was carrying today, actually. And I've been carrying that, and next to it, my field grade Gareth Bull Chamois. They're about the same overall size and similar, like color scheme, right? Just the blasted titanium with the blue accents. Two really nice EDC knives that, yeah, just I strongly recommend. They're pretty awesome.
The goblin is cool. I got to play with somebody's down in the pit a couple times at Blade Show, and I really dug that knife. I don't know if it was yours, Frank. You were definitely
It was Levin's. You had Levin's.
Oh, that's right. Goblin. It was Levin's. Yeah. And, man, that was a really cool little knife. Nice I dug it a lot.
I did not grab one at Blade, but I have one coming soon.
I thought that was already finished. I thought that was already on the way, no?
Well, no, Bill is taking his time, and I'm being very patient. I'm not, like, rushing him. I'm not stressed about it. Like, he's been working on it for the better part of a year at this point, to be perfectly honest. But I have a combo set coming from him. I've been working on something. So it's going to be an Arius and a Goblin, and I'm just going to, you know, blow up the Instagram like I try to all the time.
Like a matching pair kind of thing?
It's they're sort of a paired set. Yeah, they're not exactly matching, but they're kind of like brothers. You know, it's going
to
be.
I can't wait to see this.
It's going
to
be a nice set. It's going to be cool.
Mm. Yeah, I'm excited for that, man. And you always bring like such really, really interesting materials, I think, to the knives that you get to work on with custom makers. And so definitely.
Well, I appreciate that. It's definitely going to be in the vein of a lot of things that you've seen on the channel, just kind of an evolution of all these things that have been going on lately.
Well, actually, that kind of makes me wonder with your recent knives, it seems like you've moved towards kind of these bronze-ish colored knives, you know, bronze, black, gold kind of color schemes a little bit.
Yeah.
Are you moving away from funky green?
Never.
I think no, that'll always be a part of what I love about knives. I think that the green was always for me. A lot of people always ask why green. I find that if you ask any of these guys that anodize knives, that green, a good, consistent, repeatable green is a very difficult thing to achieve unless you know what you're doing with your anodizing bath. And some of these guys can't do it, and they don't do it very well. And so I respect a person who can do it well. And
I think anything high voltage is usually like that.
Yeah, exactly. So people who do it
like that too.
There are people who do it okay, and then there are people who are experts at it, and I try to highlight, you know, the people who are good at it.
So it's a preference for you and a technical challenge to them.
It's exactly. I like the color well enough. It's never really been my total favorite color. Probably red is my true favorite color, but it's just in knives, it's just something that is a chemistry experiment and a test of a maker, you know, so I like it.
Yeah, so, you know, with you guys, since you guys are a little bit more into the custom knives in the custom world that I've been, like Charlie and Mike and of course Frank, but Charlie, Mike, what about you guys? Is there something you like to see from a maker that is kind of, as you put it so well, like a personal preference but also a test to the maker? Is there something that you look for in makers that when they do, like it just really like pushes your buttons, it really turns you on to it? Something specific like that?
Yeah. I think for me specifically, it's I'm really into stuff that's over-engineered in terms of not necessarily in a bad way, just something that, you know, they go out of their way to make something more complicated, but with like the same level of execution. I think to when they push their own skill to do things essentially like hard mode, I like that a lot. Usually that's kind of what's going to separate a custom piece versus like a production piece. It's like, this is something that's really hard to automate. You know, a lot of these things could be challenging to do by hand, or it would be challenging to mill even, you know, like I guess the easiest example is kind of, I think Shirogorov was one of the first to not internally mill, but to really put an effort into making their, you know, their bearings look nice, into making their like internal milling look nice. And it doesn't really serve a purpose, right? When you mill out stuff, the knife is going to be lighter. How you mill it out, the patterns you make, for the most part, doesn't really matter, right? It's just how much material can you remove. And they removed it in a way that, you know, you almost think there's some like structural merit to it. And maybe there is, you know, because triangles are stronger than other shapes. But for the most part, I think their internals are very artistic. You know, the way they do the like spiral bearings, that's not any smoother than your typical like 8 or 9 bearing cage stuff that you find. Their roller bearings are also like not any smoother, but they just look really nice and unnecessary. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I'm the opposite. I have low stand. I'm the opposite of Charlie in that I still have pretty low standards. And Charlie reminds me of this in person. But I sort of have had historically sort of lower standards for fit and finish. I don't mind if something is asymmetrical or obviously handmade. However, over the last maybe 6 months or so, I'm coming around to seeing a much higher value in that. And unfortunately, it's making me love some of the knives that I have a little bit less.
It's totally a thing. In today's knife world, there are so many mechanically perfect knives. Let's see, we were just talking about the Koenig Mini Goblin. Like, that is a CNC-made knife, and it's perfect mechanically. And they're all going to be perfect because they do a good job with it. But then you get a Thorburn in your hand, and there's like a little something wrong with it, right? Something is wrong with it. Don't tell me that there's not something wrong with it, because there is. And either you like that about the handmade stuff, or it gets to you after a while.
I think my threshold for that just raised a little bit. I still don't mind seeing a little bit, like even the Talon, which is amazing. Like one of the contours on one of the tips of the scales, you know, one side's a little thicker than the other. And yeah. I don't mind it, because it's almost like a little signature, and the rest of the knife is so beautifully made. But I just had a really low threshold for that. And a lot of the knives I have definitely started to feel differently about over the last, you know, I don't know, 8 months or 9 months or something like that.
So well, I think to clarify, I don't necessarily think, you know, if something is handmade, that just means there's flaws. I don't think that's true, right? The merit, or the sign of a really good handmade knife is one that doesn't look handmade, right? But is. So, Thorburn obviously has a lot of variances with his work. And I think, you know, when you like take it apart, you can kind of see where like which pieces have more time into them. But when it comes down to it, there are a few of them out there where I think legitimately outside of, I think the flipper tab jimping, everything actually really almost looks machine made, even though it isn't. There's probably a few pieces that are pretty much super symmetrical, you know. All the parts kind of line up the way it should. The gaps are minimal, a lot less than a lot of machine pieces like Shirogorov's, and they're like, what is it called? They're bolsters or inlays or whatever you want to call them. Like the gaps on them aren't seamless. They're actually like pretty noticeable. I guess what it comes down to is just, I do like mechanical perfection, but I don't think that automatically excludes handwork. That does exclude shoddy handwork.
Yes.
But, you know.
No, I think you're right, Charlie. And you know what? I pulled out because my A5 bolster lock, I'm looking at just because Thorburn came up twice. And if someone said this was machined, I would totally believe it.
Yeah. Interesting.
So there are a few, but I mean, they're sort of far and few between the ones that hit that.
Mm-hmm. Kind of a unicornish a little bit.
So I also think it's super healthy, you know, the way new machinists, you kind of push these handmade guys to try something different, right? Because if you kind of specialize in handwork and somebody is able to reproduce that just entirely in an automated way, that means it's time for you to like step up your game in a sense, mm-hmm. right?
So I think
fair enough. That's kind of really healthy, and that's what we're currently probably in the golden age of, is just there's so many good machinists right now. They might not be really good knife makers, but they're actually very good machinists. You know, the guys who can get everything right, but, you know, maybe they lack certain, you know, character, if you want to say. Like, I think, for example, maybe the Brown Servo, mm-hmm. that's pretty much mechanically perfect.
But nail on head. Lack a bit of nail on head.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Great example.
So Craig Brown, I like him a lot. I would consider him a friend. We talk very frequently. He got I have a servo. I have one of the early servos, and he is a CNC master. He knows how to program CNC. He knows how to engineer a knife. He knows a lot about the physics and the mechanics of making a knife. But his blades are not necessarily made for cutting things, and so it's sort of a trade-off. So I got my knife sharpened. It cuts great now, but I don't know if you guys have all handled a servo. You had one for a minute there, Eugene, as well.
You know, yeah, Eugene, yeah. Eugene and I were talking about that knife and cutting just a week or so ago, and he was saying that because, Frank, yours was the first servo I ever had in hand. And it's one of those knives that you can almost immediately see that everything is really immaculately done. Just absolutely terrific work.
Mechanical perfection.
Just really astounding. But, you know, it was at Blade Show, and it was so quick. It's not like I was, you know, test cutting anything.
Right, right.
So I did not know that characteristic of his of the blades until Eugene was talking about it. However, Eugene, you're new that the servo you have now that almost looks brown is perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, so that first servo I had was number 8, and I think like what Charlie is saying, what you guys are saying and confirming is that, yeah, it's a mechanically great knife, but there are some decisions and choices made early on, I think especially early on in his design work, where you kind of get the sense, so he doesn't have like a knife user's instinct, you know, like he doesn't have the instinctive built-in understanding of how like everything would function in a day-to-day kind of application. Not to say that he doesn't know how to use knives, but I think you understand what I mean by that. Like I didn't get the sense that this was a hunter who was designing a knife for skinning animals. You see what I mean? He's an aerospace engineer, and he is bringing all of the skill from that side of his education to bear. And I think that's really awesome. And over time, you've seen him kind of adjust the way that he does certain things or most dramatically the shape of the blade. And you can see that I think he's taking in a lot of input and deciding, oh, yeah, so if I make the blade shaped more like a classic drop point, or if I increase the jimping on the flipper tab, or if I adjust the gauge of the jimping, like this will actually make it practically flow and work a little bit better than just what I have in theory. And so, yeah, I definitely think that we are, as Charlie put it, kind of in this golden age of having all these CNC machinists who just do phenomenal, phenomenal work from a mechanical perspective. But that does, you know, that doesn't by itself make a knife a great knife. Like there's also a lot of other considerations to bring in. But all that being said, like the servo that I have now, number 67, like, man, that's an incredible knife. It's probably one of my top three favorite knives in my collection right now. Especially now that I have like the Timascus backspacer clip and over travel on it. I think the colors just really pop against that, like you said, Mike, that almost brown looking anodization. But yeah, like you know, that this kind of reminds me though of something you said just a little bit ago, Mike. You said that you had kind of a lower standard or lower threshold for fit and finish kind of things.
I did. But
yeah, I kind of wonder, so then what is it about a knife, at least maybe more than 8 months ago or so, but what was it about a knife besides like fit and finish questions that really drew you to a particular maker or design or, you know, an execution or a copy of a particular knife? What kind of would put you onto it?
Wait, I don't understand the question. Say that again. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so you're saying that you weren't really looking for mechanical perfection for a while, right? Yeah, so what were you looking for instead? That's probably the better way of putting it.
I think overall design aesthetic and action, and okay. I was more willing to sacrifice some shoddy workmanship, some, you know, fit and finish. But then I ended up, and you know what? It was more recent. I ended up with a maybe three knives in a row that were just sky high compared to the others. And that was more recently. And one was a custom division Shiro a few months ago. And it was the first custom division I had in hand, and it was out of this world. And then I ended up with a mini Sabotage, which I think is probably the highest end full hand work that I've encountered. That's by Black Snow. And really those two spoiled me. Now I realized immediately I was really undervaluing it. And plus Charlie would clown on my shit all the time when he saw it at his show. He's like, look at this. So it's true. Yeah, it was just overall design aesthetic.
I was pretty impressed by the Black Snow. Or were you talking about something else?
By what, Charlie? Sorry. Oh no, not the Black Snow. I was no. I know no. You were definitely were not clowning on the Black Snow. Plenty of people do for the aesthetic, which you know they're just wrong. But no, just a lot of the other, and you know maybe a lot of the South African stuff that we were looking at together at Blade, because I brought a ton of stuff with me to Blade.
Well, yeah, I mean if it has Lockrock, you can say what you want, but I think that's wrong, right? It's quality lockrock.
No.
It's not like
no.
And none of
that's
I didn't
nice
have any lockrock
you got there.
No. Luxurious lockrock.
Maybe I'm overstating it a little bit. It's not like I was, you know, had crazy lockrock on a lot of the stuff, but just overall fit and finish was kind of boring on a lot of them.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of issues that I guess for a long time you can overlook, but eventually maybe a big difference for you is as you just kept climbing the like pricing tiers.
Yep.
At some point you're like, this is $1,500. Probably shouldn't have this issue, right?
Yeah, because materials enough are no longer alone, or an aesthetic enough is no longer alone. It has to be that weird combination where you have crazy materials that you love, an aesthetic that you totally appreciate, a useful or ergonomically comfortable knife, and the fit and finish. Like it's tough, but eventually when you're, you know, talking about certain price ranges, it has to include all those things. And yeah, I was just late to the game getting there.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because you can look for that like trifecta of good materials, good design, good execution. You can look for that trifecta at pretty much every tier of the knife hobby. I think you have to adjust your expectations as to how often you're going to run into that, run into like a perfect intersection of those things. But I think that's what keeps me tied to the production knife world, because I think that the natural progression for a lot of times is to kind of leave behind production knives and just go full into customs, you know, to take a deep dive into that. Because there's always that, as some people have described it, I think Nick Shabazz even called it this once, a hedonic adaptation.
Yeah.
Right. You just get used to these things and you start looking for the next big high. But for me, when I look at like a lower cost production knife, anything under $200, anything even under $50, if you can find somehow this trifecta of good materials, good workmanship, and good design, it just wows me, you know, so much. And it's weird because I'll have my Brown Servo in one hand, but then be tempted to buy this $60 knife on the other hand, which literally is 1/10 of the base price of a Servo, right? It's crazy how you can find that pretty much at every tier. And I think that's what keeps the hobby exciting and is drawing more and more people in. Like, you know, these days, finding like a well done knife under $50 is not as hard or questionable as it used to be. You know, I joke that the CRKT I bought for the first time, you know, it was $25 and I couldn't believe I was paying that much money for it, but then turned out that it wasn't a very good knife, you know, in the long run. These days, $25, $30, it can buy you a lot of knife. It's pretty impressive what's out there these days.
What would you say, I mean, for people who haven't really, I know a lot of people are still kind of on their way, you know, they still have like $100 knives that are, they're waiting for their next paycheck or the next big event to try and justify. So what would you say are some of like the biggest like stepping stones, or like what do you think you unlock at different price points? So
that's a great question. Yeah.
Well, I tell everyone, people who ask me what knife should I buy, if they're at the lower end, I tell everyone to get a paramilitary too. Everyone. I feel like that is a stepping stone in the sense that that is the perfect cutting tool, and people need to appreciate having a knife as a cutting tool, first and foremost. I think that's a good place to start. I think you unlock that at $100.
Okay.
God, I have to confess that I've never had a PM2 in hand.
I'm telling you, man, you've got to have one just to understand. Like all of the rest of the knives that you have, you're like, wow, these actually don't cut anything. This knife actually cuts stuff. It's a totally different approach.
I'm not used to that world.
I know, right? Like you have a bunch of custom knives that, like, you know, they might cut paper, but they don't really cut anything very well. They're just beautiful. But
they
might not cut paper, I'm telling you.
they might not. That's funny.
Yeah, so
yeah. But I think at $100, I mean, I think that's one of those, like the paramilitary too is one of those knives that kind of meets those three criteria. Like you're getting G10, which I don't think any of us would look at as a luxurious material, but compared to FRN, you know, it's a little bit more robust. You can do a little bit more with it if you know how to work with it and machine it the way that, you know, Spyderco apparently does do a decent job with, you know. You're getting slightly better materials. Yeah. You're getting good construction, you know, the Golden Colorado models. They're not without their flaws, but their flaws are usually not as bad as some other knives that you might find in that price range. And you're getting a solid design. So I think that's kind of when you first taste a little bit of that. But these days it's different, right? Because you could get, I mean, I hear what you're saying, Frank, about the PM2 being just a great starter knife if you're shopping around that $100, $120 price range. But these days you can even get like M390 on like a $150 knife or like a $70 knife or $80 knife if you catch one of these exclusives, these dealer exclusives by like Kershaw, for example. I mean, it seems like some of those milestones are blurring a little bit as the knife industry is changing. So maybe you're getting more value out of that $100 than you used to be able to.
I think it's blurred quite a bit in the sense that I think for most people just more expensive is better, right? And eventually I think around the $200-$300 mark, maybe $400, that's when you realize that isn't the case at all, especially if you're buying customs in that price. So, if you have like $400 or $500 customs, odds are pretty good that these are not as good as your $200-$300 production knives. Mm-hmm. Especially when it comes to, you know, the biggest fad right now is all these like knife flippers and knife action. I don't think price buys you better, especially above maybe $100, $150. I'd even say
absolutely.
It's very minimal. What you do buy is maybe a bit more consistency. So, you know, a bit more care goes into your Shirvarovs and your ZTs than your Kaisers, right? So, you know, the people who expect, oh, your $600 knife is just going to blow away the action on a $150 knife, that's not necessarily true. Especially, you know, with more and more, companies that seem to be prioritizing action. Because I've had like a few really, really good ones from, you know, from Wii, from North Arms. I don't know if that's a production company, but
yeah, North Arms. Like the yeah, Scott, I don't know if you guys classify it
as a production is kind of what I mean. So like ZT even, I think the 0450 is still really good. Maybe like the flipper tab jimping isn't the greatest, but I still think that's a really good flipper that is better than a lot of customs, even in like $1,000 range. And I think people, you know, chasing this whole drop shut fad, I don't know if it's a fad. It's fun to play with, but, you know, it's not just,
There's a limit. There's a limit.
Yeah, I think so.
It's not a good thing anymore.
I think, so I guess what I'm getting down to is, what money ends up buying you at these astronomical prices that, maybe a few of us right now are kind of playing in relatively, right? It's all relative. But, you know, for $1,000, $2,000, what are you actually getting? When people say, you're definitely getting that, you know, it took me 2 years to get it, and you can try and get one, but you can't. Good luck, right? That's one aspect of it. And another part where we say it's amazing fit and finish, it's kind of subjective. On that level, you have to really look for it and care about it. You know, like for me, it's like, oh, the inlays, you can't feel them. And that's like $500 worth of, you know. But on the same part, I think when it comes to action, though, it's a lot of that is character. I think Rezentes have like a certain character to them. Thorburns obviously have a certain character. Rexfords, Lee Williams, they all flip in a certain way that maybe mechanically isn't actually better than like a servo or even a ZT or something like that. But it just has that level of, well, no production company has reproduced this, you know, action holistically, you know, from acoustics, from D10 feel, everything just cannot be reproduced. To me, like a React feels like a React. Every React kind of feels sort of like a React for whatever reason.
True. Very true. Mm-hmm. Wii is the same way.
Yeah, Wii is kind of the same way. It's not a bad thing. They've got a very good recipe going on, right? It's like Papa John. You don't have to change it. But it's not gourmet, right?
Mm.
Right.
And the gourmet experience may not necessarily be for everyone. It might not actually.
Like, I had a friend who. It might just be worse. They screwed up this pizza.
I mean, I had a friend who, when he would take his girlfriend out to these fancy high-end restaurants, he'd always have to stop by at the McDonald's on his way home because he just would never get to eat enough. And yeah, I mean, it's kind of like that with nines too. I think pretty much with any field, but yeah, I think that's why we all kind of find our places where we kind of settle in and decide, oh, this is a good place to camp out for me, or at least this is where I want to be exploring right now because it scratches a certain kind of indescribable itch, you know, or unidentifiable itch that we just might feel. And I guess that kind of leads me to this other question for you guys. It's related to the question that started this all off. So the question we started at the beginning of this episode was, you know, what was the knife that got you into this? But I guess I'm kind of curious, just what is the knife that has surprised you recently, or a knife that has really kind of taken your attention recently, like just really one that you maybe you haven't had it long enough to really fall in love with it, but one that has really just wowed you for whatever reason.
I mean, I'll probably have to think longer, but off the bat, I think you guys mentioned the Mini Goblin. That was surprisingly amazing. Just the overall package. I'm really happy that they're open to making these smaller models. The design is probably going to be polarizing for a lot of people, being like a shark knife kind of design, but I mean, there's pretty much nothing wrong with that knife, I think. There's probably a few others. I think the servo too, right? Them going to the drop point, I think they're pretty much kind of following in the footsteps of Grimmsall, like coming out with a blade shape that's kind of polarizing and then stepping back and creating something that's more reserved, right?
I'll tell you, I like the original blade shape significantly more. That's my personal opinion.
I mean,
what do you like about it? What do you like about it?
Wait, on the servo?
The aesthetic?
Yes. The aesthetic. Like, as for the knife as a whole, in an open position, it just is more balanced with the shape of the handle. Visually more balanced. The lines are better. To me, it's just my opinion. And I'm biased in any way owning the original version.
But, well, yours is also very special. You know, it's got that pretty sick vertebral column on it. I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I like it.
Frank, I never told you this, but when I handled yours at Blade Show, to be honest, it was the knife that surprised me and wowed me more than any other knife that you brought to Blade Show 2018.
Really?
So
same for me, Frank.
Yeah, oh, wow. I mean, I loved everything else that you had. I mean, the fact that I got a chance to handle your mini Typhoon made me want to buy a mini Typhoon. You know, the Sham just really just blew me away with how good it was, but it was the servo that left the longest impression. And so that's the knife that I really started chasing in earnest after Blade Show 2018.
Well, definitely the servo blew me away when I got it. I had no idea what to expect. I just randomly jumped on. I saw that Craig opened his books, and I knew that Snuggle Bunny was doing it and Jim Skelton was doing it. And I was like, well, I'm Dr. Brunke. I'm going to fucking do it too. So I did it, and I just jumped on the boat, and it really did blow me away. And it's the thing about it is this. I have number 13, and Craig just sent me number 79 or 78, the green one that he just sold on Friday. He sent me that for about 2 or 3 days to just sort of get a feel for it and see what it was like. It's a radically different knife in all the right ways. Like, it's better than the one that I have. So definitely, I mean, Eugene, you have a late model one, so you can see the differences between the early models and now.
Oh,
so.
Yeah. It's like night and day.
It's a great thing, and he's done a good job and evolved the knife. I would say the Koenig Arius is one that stuck with me. It's been around for a long time, but it's so damn good that I'm getting another one. Knives that just really impress. The problem that I'm having, guys, is actually quite the opposite. And maybe I've discussed this with some of you guys. I am disillusioned right now. Mm. I'm going through a mid-knife crisis, if you will. Because I've reached this point where I started, you know, with basic production knives, and then I've gone all the way up into these crazy, hyper-expensive customs. And now it's like I've seen the whole spectrum, and it's like where is the really good stuff? Where is the true – just like what Shabazz is saying he's doing, let's find the gems. And it's an eternal struggle because you think something is good or you expect it to be good and then it's crap or vice versa. It's always nice to get the good ones. The Shamwari that I recently got is perfect. It's the greatest knife maybe ever. The Talon – is right there with it. The Talon has blown me away with how good it is. It feels – so you guys talked about how making a handmade knife seem like it's made by CNC. If you told me that Bill Koenig made the Talon off of his Arius production line, I would believe you. That's how good it feels. It's that crisp. It's that perfect. So those were some pleasant surprises for me. I'm waiting for some new deliveries, and I'll talk more about those as they come in, but – Those have been mine.
But then overall, you're kind of feeling a little bit of that burnout, huh?
I feel burned out. I don't know what to say. Like, there's so many frame lock flippers and so many good knives, and there's a billion of them, and I'm overwhelmed that I just like, where is my passion in this anymore? And I'm finding it, but it's different than it used to be. So.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're talking to Frank about this, but like, I think for me, following his channel, I would classify his rock bottom as when he had 30392s, and one of them was just this teal, weird, is it teal, orange, turquoise kind of a color?
You thought that was rock bottom for me?
I think that was
rock bottom.
You were climbing, and then you kind of settled, and then you became this modder. You know what I mean? Everything just needed to be pimped.
I went through a hardcore modding phase. I still do it. I still mod a lot of my knives. Most of my production knives.
It's classier now, though.
It's true, but I mean,
I think now the biggest difference is you get the makers to pimp them, which is not really pimping, right?
That's like the ultimate thing. That's what I've really enjoyed the most, and that's what you're going to see in the next few months. Like, as these deliveries come in, I've been able to coordinate these, like, materials placements into these things. That's just, that's the most fun. Pimping, pre-pimping, you know, pimpception. I don't even know how to say it. Like, putting that pimp into their minds and making them make it for me. It's like the greatest achievement in knives. And that's where my joy is coming from now. Almost all the knives that I'm ever going to keep forever are going to end up being that kind of a creation. And so that's what the next phase I think will be for me.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty similar. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. like you always want to get something that, you know, you want the makers to kind of prove themselves with a model or two. You want to get a feel for their work. And once they kind of like exceed all expectations, then you definitely want to get a model that you simply, you know, you don't simply see very often, right? So like what Frank said, he's been able to coordinate. I think that's a luxury that most of us probably won't be able to have, is to, you know, but you do want yours to be a little bit personalized. You can call it pimping, but it's more of just, you know, having that one knife that people can see and they're going to kind of associate with you, and you can kind of associate that knife with like something that's your own. And I think that's what customs are about, is just like not having a piece that everyone else has and it's all serialized, but having one that's unique and specific in a way. So it's just kind of going for that one-off piece that is really hard to acquire, either because, you know, the maker's books are closed indefinitely, or just he won't make one in this configuration kind of a thing. I think that to me is very appealing, and that kind of is the only way to keep the chase going, at least with regards to, I think, a lot of us right now. We can afford pretty much any knife we want. It's just, for one, it's how you justify it. And two, it's just, I don't want a knife that I can just click a button and have. You know, I want to pry it off someone who also loves it. That's how I know it's special. It's not something, oh, I'm going to a garage sale and I pick this up. But I'm literally, you know, prying it off of somebody. I think those are the pieces that are special to me, I think.
Yeah, collection as victory in some sense. Yeah. Well, what about you, Mike? Like, what stands out to you lately? Anything catch your attention these days?
You know, what Frank was saying a couple minutes ago, I think, was important, because at some point you're going to reach a level where you're not going to, it's unlikely that you're going to discover something brand new that is on the same tier. And there are only so many makers that can do this. Like Frank was talking about his talent, like Frank Fisher and Rob Carter. You're already talking about nosebleed level knives. Like, yes. What are you gonna find out there? You know, like as you're making the journey to that, you're constantly discovering things. But by now, it's not like you're gonna open Instagram and see something on that tier from some maker.
Yeah, the thrill is gone, man. There's no more like mystery to this game.
You know, I mean, you know, and I don't have the funds to like start collecting, you know, full custom Shirogorovs and or Rexfords.
Right.
You kind of have to end up like Frank was saying, you know, just doing extra special configurations with custom builds in order to really make them your own, and get and appreciate it more that way. And I kind of plateaued, you know. I'm only looking for excuses to bring up the fact that I have a mini Sabotage, right? But really, I got the Sabotage and just, you know, by the end of the day, I was like, well, I arrived. I don't know what to do now. I don't know what to look for.
Yeah, you have the most perfect custom knife like, in the world.
It was the one I wanted. That was I rarely use the word grail, but it really was that to me. And, you know, there are a few makers, but most of them are out of my range, you know, just being at USN at the show, the Lee Lehrman stuff, of course. And this is all predictable stuff. It's not like I have anything creative, you know. Yeah, like, sure, Lee Lehrman, Rexford, Fisher Cut. I mean, you know, the same ultra, ultra high-end stuff that everybody else wants, I guess. But
are you into that Lee Williams, the Bolsterlock, Lee Williams?
Yeah, Lee Williams, I don't like as much as you. I mean, I gave you my lottery ticket, but
good man.
You know, it's really hard when you hit a certain point. You know, what are you going to look for? And in fact, some of the stuff is just for general interest and not stuff that's going to be better. It's just different. Like I was texting with the Cultrotech folks today to order something, and you know, I don't expect it's going to be better than something. It's just a different you know, a different knife to, you know, broaden the portfolio or whatever you want to call it.
Okay, so yeah, Mike, I've kind of been in that area too. So one of the things I do, sort of similar to Eugene, is, you know, I still like to keep a pulse on all the production pieces, I think, because a lot of them are somewhat interesting. Like the Wii Paroma, I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, I have a video on that.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, I mean, I just buy those. I try those just to get a feel for, you know, maybe there's something interesting there. I don't know. It's just because I think at this point it's just so hard to get, you know, quote unquote, like a grail piece, because at this point your grails are fucking like real grails, right? Either monetarily, right, or just there's just none out there.
Or availability, right.
Yeah, so, you know, to go on this hiatus of not getting anything new kind of sucks for us, right? As addicts, like as people with issues.
You're right. And, you know, Charlie, your point is well taken, because I would not have gone over to the Spider-Go table unless you texted me to come over and meet you. And then I got to see that the Recenti, what's the model, Eugene, that they're
Paizan.
Doing?
Paizan.
The Paizan. The Paizan. And I got to see that Smock. And it ended up being really
sabotage.
Cool. The Subvert or whatever you call it. But sabotage. I was totally out of touch. And it was really fun being at the table. So, it might sound funny, but maybe to reinvigorate things, I'll end up getting some, sub-$500 production kind of things.
I'm telling you, man, that's where I have all the fun. Modding knives like that, it's just fun. It's just, it's a time killer. It's like making a new knife. You get to make it yourself. I have a lot of fun modding those knives.
Man,
I don't care if it turns out looking like a unicorn's turd, like that 392 did. But you know, it's fine.
I'm not saying it looked bad. I'm just saying it didn't look that good.
You can say it looks bad. I don't think it was perfect either, but it was just fun, and people certainly remembered it, and they got their attention.
I wouldn't describe it as perfect either.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. A lot of people hated it. I found a lot of Fanatic Edge haters by posting pictures that night.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, it's funny, because I'm hearing you guys, and I can relate to a certain degree, but what I'm realizing is that the way I approach this hobby is just a little bit, I think, just a little bit different. Probably a lot of similarity, but there's just, I think, one shade that's a little different, where I think for me, I'm not looking for a unique knife. So the rarity of a knife, or the fact that somebody else wants a knife, actually doesn't make me want it more in most cases. I mean, definitely with that texture cham that I had for a while with the Zerk collar, or the Zerk Overtravel, sorry, it didn't have the collar, and the Zerk standoff. I mean, I hesitated letting that knife go. I need the money, but I hesitated letting it go because I just kept thinking, well, you know, there's so few of them out there. How many people have this knife in this configuration, yada, yada, yada.
Three.
But aside from, yeah, basically, yeah, three. So, but aside from kind of individual or particular specific knives like that one, generally speaking, like rarity or the uniqueness of a knife doesn't really speak to me. I think what I get more surprised by is when I come across a knife that without any of my input, you know, without any of my suggestion, like it just already checks all the boxes. Like I look at it and I think, wow, there was some maker out there who thought that this would look cool just like I think it looks cool, or who thought that this is how a knife should behave just the way that I think a knife should behave. And so for me, I'm kind of looking for, I guess, the pearl in the oyster. You know, it's already there. It's already what I want, but I just don't know where it is yet, you know? And when I find it, like, I don't care if it's been made 10,000 times over. It just speaks to me because it just clicks with me. And that might mean that I'm a really basic person. You know, maybe my tastes are just as basic as they come, but, I mean, I can only live my own life, right? So I guess there's something like that to it. And so for me, like, that's part of why I keep the 0801 TI, you know, the ZT 0801 TI. I love that knife. It's not an expensive knife. It's not a rare knife. In fact, gosh, they must have done like a half dozen different configurations of that production, but I still love it. And I know it's based off of a custom that I'm sure is just an incredible knife on its own. But this sub $200 ZT, I'm just gaga over it because it gets so much right, and it just get at least for me, you know, it just clicks so much for what I'm looking for in a knife. And I didn't even have to ask anybody to make it that way. So it's kind of funny. I think that's also what keeps me rooted in the production knife world, because I'm always searching for a knife that just coincidentally matches everything that I like. It's kind of a weird approach to collecting, but yeah.
Is that more ZT or is that more Rexford, do you think?
I think that it's more Rexford, because if I had the chance, I'd buy a Rexford. I'm pretty sure that's true for anyone, right? But yeah, I mean, I think it is more Rexford, but what makes it accessible is, of course, the collaboration with ZT. You know, that they're bringing a decent level of skill to the table. They're able to produce it at a sufficiently high level of proficiency so that their manufacturing does not get in the way of the design. It doesn't necessarily enhance it, but it doesn't get in the way of it.
I think like internally milled that knife and made like a slightly more interesting backspacer, that would be one of the best knives out on the market. I don't know if they actually do internal milling though.
Which knife is this?
The ZT 0801.
Oh, 0808.
Yeah, 0808 is fantastic as well. I mean, another Rexford design, right? But the 0801 Ti, instead of doing internal milling, they just, you know, drilled those holes through the side, which my wife hates, but I love, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I think Eugene touched on an interesting point where collections may define you more as a person. I think Eugene is a really nice dude. You know, he's like a pastor and stuff. And like, he's not out there to like, you know, cut somebody's throat or be better than somebody or be, you know, have the only one of its kind. You know what I mean? But, you know, kind of, you know, my personality is like, I want to have the only one like this. So like, when they were making the talons, when they were like, they're going to be 7 talons and they're all going to be the same. I was like, can we talk about that, please? Can we just change that? And then, like, the chamois and all these other things. So I really enjoy having personalized items. I don't know. That's my thing. It's a new
thing. So you guys...
And you're really good at making that happen somehow.
Right.
It's been a blessing. I'll just say that. It's great.
Well, Frank also likes to just corner markets, like with the BBM. Well, there's this many, and I can get half of them.
I make people think I just made a run on BBMs. I had 4 of them at one point. I only have 2.
In a way, it's more exclusive net, so.
It's true.
Yeah, that reminds me of Thanos, you know, like shutting down that whole planet, you know, in order to, so that no one else could have an infinity gauntlet like him. That's pretty much what it is. Yeah. Yeah. You would wipe out half the knife world to make sure you have all the NCC knives, huh?
I mean, you said it. It was your words, but, you know, I may feel that similar. You want to call me Knife Thanos? That's okay. That's fine.
You actually do it too. Yeah, brain doctor. Just one at a time.
Just one at a time. There you go. Oh my goodness. Except you'd have to change your color from green to purple, which isn't bad. Purple's nice. Right. You know?
I need that shirt. I need that to be a shirt.
Knife Thanos.
Will put knives disappear with a click.
I remember, isn't there a sprint run of the 0801? I think there was a sprint run or two, right?
It was the 390, the bronze
one. A couple
one.
Of them. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the bronze blackwash one or whatever.
Bronze blackwash with a carbon fiber insert, I think.
Yeah. You should just do that.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that would be kind of compared, like looking at the rest of my collection, that would probably be my ideal configuration. But I really like the milled holes in this handle, you know?
Have some milled holes. Easy.
Actually, I have a power drill and a titanium bit, right? So I could probably do something with that, or carbide bit, sorry. I could probably just do that myself, right?
Please start doing that.
Just drilling holes into my knives. Yeah, I need some kind of gimmick to get more people to watch my YouTube channel, so yeah, maybe I could do that. Well, I mean, we've touched on a lot of different topics here, and I feel like we've started to tease a bunch of topics as well. So I think that it would probably be great for us to save some more of that conversation for the next episode of Knife Life Podcast. Once again, we're just really glad that you joined us and excited to get started on this podcast. And yeah, my name's Eugene Kwan. Again, you can find me at that name on Instagram and then on YouTube as well. And yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing from more of you guys. You guys want to say your names one more time and say and have a sign off together?
Sure. I'm Frank again, Dr. Frunky on YouTube, Instagram, and you can hit me at gmail.com, Dr. Frunky.
I'm Mike Blumenblade on Instagram, and that's it.
Yeah, and I'm Charlie, Accidentally Knives, and that's it.
All right, guys, you guys all have a nice knife life. Take care.
Thank you.